Hello, Star Trek fans, and welcome to Season 2 of Rebinge Deep Space Nine. My name is Kim.
And my name is James.
And we're watching every episode of Star Trek Deep Space Nine from the beginning, one episode at a time. Welcome back to the podcast. Today we are in Season 2, Episode 1, entitled The Homecoming. This episode aired September 26, 1993.
Now, this is the season I started watching on a regular basis.
So you didn't start watching from episode one?
No, I wasn't in the country yet.
Huh, I had forgotten that. So you came in season two, episode one, and then figured it out from there?
It wasn't episode one. It was one of the later episodes that I got interested in and then, you know, basically watched everything I could because it was always on rerun somewhere.
Oh, so you caught up somehow in reruns like over the summer or something between the seasons. Oh,
yeah,
wow.
Exactly.
Yeah, because you certainly couldn't stream it or find it anywhere back in the 90s. That was not possible. You had to catch it on TV.
Right, exactly.
Interesting.
I think I got you to record a lot of them for me.
Wow, that was nice of me.
Yeah, you were great. You were a good friend.
Well, before we get going on Season 2, Episode 1, anything you want to talk about from the end of Season 1 and the last podcast that we did?
It was a spectacular ending to a season that went up and down all over the place.
Yeah, there were some clunkers there towards the end. We finished on a high note for sure, although I would say that it felt a bit dark and grim there towards the end with the things that were going on.
Yeah.
And it certainly didn't end with any kind of like hopeful ending, I guess. It wasn't a big cliffhanger or anything, but it just didn't. It wasn't like a lighthearted ending, I guess.
Oh, yes. It was an ending that had hope, though, with Sisko and Kira both going to work on the report together.
Yes, that's true, except we were concerned about Vedic Wynn. We were concerned about... What were we concerned about? I don't even remember now. Well, she had tried to kill Beryl, and they hadn't caught her. So they basically, they knew that Vedic Wynn had done something, but there's nothing they could do about it. And they just sort of went about their business.
Yes. And you saw a lot of the tensions between Starfleet and the Bajorans, and also the internal strife that was starting to affect the Bajorans again of the infighting.
Right. Well, should we start season two and see how this one goes?
I am just impressed that you managed to watch all the way through to season two and very happy.
It was a little bumpy there for a while. Every time Bashir did something creepy, I wanted to turn the show off, but I made it through.
Yes, you did.
I will say that we've watched a little bit ahead here because it was a multi-part episode at the beginning. And in the first three episodes, there's no evidence of sexual harassment by Julian Bashir. So it's a shocker.
Yes.
So maybe we have already improved.
It's worth mentioning that when it comes to a multi-part episode, we're going to watch all the parts of it and then come back and talk about the individual episodes. So we can get the whole story arc straight in our minds, as it were.
Yeah. So the season opens with a three-parter, and so we've watched all three parts. Although I haven't taken detailed notes on anything except episode one, but I do at least know how the story goes. Yes.
And Kim's notes are very detailed.
Yes. It's a good thing that typing is my number one skill. Okay, you ready?
I am ready.
We open in a very busy Quarks with an overhead shot. Someone shouts Dabo because someone is always shouting Dabo. This feels like a very Star Trek-y opening to a new season. I mean, the music is lighthearted, the aliens are laughing, you're looking down on a bustling scene, and you're supposed to think time has just sort of moved on, you know, to normalcy from the end of the previous season.
This is a very nice pan sequence where they go from the promenade through to the second level of Quarks and down.
Yeah.
Clearly, the set budget has increased for the second season.
So is the promenade... I know there are multi-parts or multi-levels on the promenade.
Yeah.
So is the second level also the promenade or just the first level?
Good question. I actually looked this up because I was interested in it. And it turns out the promenade is just the central hub, but it's multi-levels in the central hub. So it goes like all the way around and there's upper and lower levels of it.
Yeah. What I was thinking was all the way around the outside if we were going to talk about the promenade as a whole. But that makes more sense if it's the inside ring. Okay.
Yeah, that would be enormous. The outer ring would be very big.
We see Quark rushing through the bar, and Odo stops him. Odo wants to discuss the subite freighter that Quark claimed was smuggling isolinear rods to Bajor. Quark is trying to shush him, but Odo continues at full volume, and we see Rom is in the background eavesdropping. He conducted an investigation, and he says, "Do you know what I discovered?" And Quark whispers, "That I was telling the truth." And Odo says, "That's right." Quark congratulates him for making an arrest and tries to run off again, but Odo isn't finished. Quark says, "There's no pleasing you. I help you crack a notorious smuggling ring, and yet you still insist on treating me like the enemy. Well, you are the enemy, Odo says. Quark says, well, then how do you explain my helping you? And Odo says, I can't. And Quark says, we've been at each other's throats long enough. I figured it was time to call a truce. Truce. Odo scoffs. First one of the season. Maybe the Odo scoff will be the new drinking game if we ever stop playing the provisional government drinking game.
Oh, that's a really good idea. I like that one.
Quark says, from now on, you and I are going to be friends. Odo's like, I don't think so. And he leaves.
I think Quark's being a little bit hopeful there.
Well, yeah. Rom approaches and Quark says he doesn't remember Odo ever looking so perplexed. Rom is also perplexed. Those smugglers were a potential source of great profit. Quark says, must I quote the 76th rule of acquisition? Every once in a while, declare peace. It confuses the hell out of your enemies.
I like the way Rom is, again, not quite up on all the rules. The way he stands there and is like,
He's like, 76, 76, yeah.
You can see how he's trying to go through them in his head.
Yes.
Rom is not a very good Ferengi at heart, really.
No, he's not. He's a little bumbling. I did notice, too, that Odo is a little bit more golden in color this season.
Ah, still working on that makeup.
Yeah, still not perfected, obviously.
Did you notice in the conversation between Odo and Quark, the very purple dress of the woman at the other side of the bar?
No. Well spotted.
Yes, we have started with the purples already. Very important.
Yes, that's true. Quark then heads up the circular staircase and he sees a woman in a very tight, mostly black leather-like costume. I don't think it was leather. It looked more like either pleather or maybe plastic or vinyl. But she had purple hair. I did notice that.
Yes.
Memory Alpha tells me that she is a Boslik freighter captain and smuggler named Rio Naj, which Quark knew doesn't say her name, but Memory Alpha told me.
Yeah, she had surprisingly good makeup and costume for somebody who was only in one scene, and it wasn't a very long one either, when we saw the famous awful wigs and the tinfoil stuck to the stuck to the uniform.
Yeah, no, her costume was definitely pretty good. I did find it a little awkward the first time we see her. We get her standing at the top of the circular staircase, and the camera is literally between her legs looking up. I didn't think that was necessary.
Remember, they used the light 7 of 9.
From the top down, this was a different angle. This was so much worse. Well, she sits down on the staircase, coming to eye level with Quark, and she says, hi, Quark, how are your lobes? Oh my God, we're already starting with the smarminess. He says, tingling at the sight of you. She tells him that her ship is about to leave, and she has something that needs to get to Bajor. She holds up an earring and says she got it from a maintenance worker on Cardassia 4. Quark is like, a Cardassian gave you a Bajoran earring? She says he asked me to take it to Bajor, said whoever I showed it to would understand. There must be someone here who would know what to do with it. There is, Quark says, taking the earring, me. And then he kisses her on the cheek and then heads down the stairs.
One of the things about Quark is he can so easily be manipulated by a pretty face. I mean, for all his Ferengi business savvy, all it takes is a pretty woman and all his business sense goes out the window.
And he told Rom not to fall for things like that, and then he goes and sort of does it.
Exactly, yes.
I think in this case, though, he was thinking, this thing might be worth something. I'll take it and see what I can get for it. Although if he was really going to try to get money for it, taking it to Kira was not the right thing to do.
No.
That's what he does next.
In this scene, when it opens, you see a member of Starfleet in uniform and a Bajoran officer in uniform walk into the bar together. So are we seeing Starfleet and the Bajorans actually starting to socialize, which was one of the criticisms from the previous episode?
That's right. Neela said that they weren't intermingling.
Yeah, which I still found surprising. I would have thought Sisko would have told the Starfleet crew to, you know, make friends of the Bajorans, make the effort. So I thought that was an interesting touch, given that what we knew about the previous episode in the previous season. So in overanalyzing it, was this a subtle move by the writers to show that that was starting to happen?
I think it's a very important part of this storyline, of this three-parter, that they are starting to intermingle, that they are starting to trust each other. They are starting to work together. I mean, Sisko talked about it in that speech that he gave to the evil Vedic.
Yep.
He talked about how the people who had been working together had learned to trust each other. It was maybe going on, but maybe it wasn't so visible on the entire station. It was maybe just kind of visible to the crew.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Good point.
So did we see Morn in this scene?
I don't think so. I studied the background and as much as I could and looked at everything and could not see Morn. So where's Morn?
Interesting. Yeah, where is Morn? You'd think this is exactly the kind of thing that he would be hanging out in because he loves a party. He loves an angry mob and a party.
Yep. Two of his favorite things.
Now we go to Kira, with her impeccable posture, standing in a dark room in front of a small table with two lit candles and what I think is a Bajoran religious symbol hanging over it. She's standing there with her arms up in the air like she's being held up, which I guess is some kind of meditation, but it looks the opposite of meditative to me. I'd be thinking of how much my arms hurt if I stood like that for very long. But then the door chimes and she sighs and she blows out the candles and says, "Come in," and it's Quark. He's leaning on the doorway and he says, "Surprise! I've always wondered what your quarters look like. What do you want?" Kira asks. He says, "You don't entertain much, do you?" And she says, "Oh, I entertain a lot. I just don't entertain you." Love it.
Quark deserves the put down at every chance.
Ugh, yeah. She walks through the dark room into her bedroom and Quark makes some suggestive comments, of course, from the doorway of that room. And she says, "You take one step in here, it'll be your last." He says, "It would be worth it." And then she says, "You've got 5 seconds to tell me what you want." And he says, "Aren't you going to offer me a beverage?" He's so annoying. And then she starts counting down from five and pushing him out the door. But he says, "Wait, I brought you something." And he holds up the earring and she is immediately intrigued. She asks where he got it and she grabs it from him. He asks if it's valuable, of course, and tells him about it coming from Cardassia 4. She stomps out, earring in hand. "Consider it a gift," he shouts after her, and we cue the theme song. That was a great opening.
Yeah. I would question why she left Quark in her quarters. I mean, I wouldn't leave him there. The two things he would probably do are go through all your drawers and steal stuff. Or equally as likely, set up a lot of hidden webcams.
Well, that now makes me worry. Although, yeah, they don't have any cameras. If they had cameras, they'd be actually watching the promenade. And they never are. They never know what the hell's going on.
So this was something interesting enough to get Kira's attention. So the freighter captain was right when she said, "Show it to somebody and they'll know what to do."
Yes. She said that there must be someone from Bajor here because the maintenance worker said, if you give this to someone from Bajor, they'll know what to do.
Ah.
So Sisko's walking through the promenade when Jake runs down the stairs to meet him. Jake is wearing a very muted green outfit this season. This is a real downgrade of colors for him.
He's also 7 feet tall.
I was going to say, he's nearly as tall as his dad now. His legs are definitely as long. Jake says he has some great news. He asked out the Bajoran girl he was telling his dad about. He needs some advice on what they could do on their date. He was thinking of taking her to a hollow suite, and Sisko's like, no, you're too young for that. He says, "How about our quarters?" No quarters. So then he tells him to try going upstairs and watching the ships through the wormhole, but Jake is like, "That's boring. It's my first date. I don't want it to be my last." I do think this is evidence of the intermingling of Starfleet with the Bajorans.
Yeah, I think this is another hint towards that.
Yeah.
And I like Jake's line in response to the watching the wormhole, which is when Sisko said, "Since when do you find the wormhole boring?" And Jake responds with, "Since I started going out with girls."
Well, that makes sense.
Oh, Jake, you're such a teenager.
Yeah. Kira arrives saying she needs to talk to Sisko. Jake heads off saying he'll come up with some ideas of his own. Don't worry about it. Sisko and Kira then head into a place that I thought was Quark's, but it is not. It looks like some kind of cafeteria, and I suddenly realize, how many times did I think we were in Quark's when we were really in this place?
I don't know. I don't think this had been introduced by this point.
I looked it up on Memory Alpha, and it tells me it was also in Season 1, but it didn't have a name.
Oh.
Exactly, but because there were many times in Season 1 where I would say they were in Quark's when somebody was just sitting and eating, like it was Bashir, you know, talking to that Bajoran when he was hitting on her. Yep. I think they were in this place.
Oh.
It's difficult to distinguish this room between Quark's because they look pretty similar, but this room is actually smaller.
Yeah, and there are no vines.
And there are no vines, okay. Sisko orders a Ractogino with a Jacarine peel. Then he orders an Icoberry Tort from a different replicator. Why would you have to go to a different replicator to order a tort? Does the one only do drinks? It's like the coffee machine.
One vending machine does drinks, the other does food. He seems very upbeat here.
He does. I like the idea of there being a cafeteria, you know, and that we aren't always going to Quark's. This makes perfect sense, but I really missed that this existed before.
Well, the set budget had increased enough so they could add some more rooms.
Maybe. Later in the episode, Sisko calls this the Replomat.
Yeah.
I don't think we've heard that word before, but I definitely appreciated it.
Oh, I don't think we've heard that before.
So they sit down at a table, and Kira is looking antsy. She says she needs to borrow a runabout, and she doesn't want to say why, but he says, "I can't loan you a Starfleet runabout without knowing where you plan to take it." So Kira tells him she needs to go to Cardassia 4 to rescue a Bajoran prisoner of war. She shows him the earring and says, "This is the insignia of Lee Nalis, the greatest resistance leader we ever had." Sisko remembers that he was reported missing in action, and Kira says, yeah, but his body was never found. She wouldn't ask if it wasn't necessary, but Bajoran ships just don't have the maneuverability or the defensive capabilities to get her safely in and out of Cardassian territory. Sisko looks closer at the earring, asking if it's genuine. She had Dax analyze it and do a genetic analysis, and it matched Lee's DNA record, so she believes it to be genuine. Sisko asks if she told the provisional government,
drink,
but she says the ministers are unwilling to risk going to war with Cardassia over an earring, and the provisional government, drink, is made up of political opportunists too busy fighting amongst themselves to care what happens to Bajor. So it sounds like a true government then.
Yeah, it sounds like, yeah, this isn't provisional anymore. This is a full-blown proper government.
Right, except it's still called provisional. So since the loss of the Kai, the situation has gone from bad to worse. There are reports of factional fighting and race riots. Bajor needs a leader, someone that people will listen to and trust, and Kira thinks that could be Lee.
So clearly here, Bajor is still suffering from political and religious strife, and now it sounds like it's also introduced a racial element. Yeah, all they need is a pandemic, and it's the modern day.
Gosh.
Like I said, feels like we're in 1968.
Let's not dwell on reality.
Yes.
I can't take it.
Yeah.
Just then, O'Brien calls, saying Sisko and Odo had better come to the Habitat Ring, Level 13, Section 4. There's something they need to see. So Sisko jumps up to leave, leaving his rack to Gino and Tort completely untouched, which was disappointing. He tells Kira he has to think it over.
Well, Kira completely killed the mood. I mean, he was going to have a drink and a dessert,
yes,
and then she comes in with some very heavy
and
stuff.
His coffee, and she's just like, I got to go to Cardassia. Like, oh man.
Yes.
We go to the Habitat Ring and a dark hallway with Odo, Sisko, and Miles. Miles was on his way to do some repair work on the field modulators, because that's what Miles does, when he noticed some graffiti. It's a bright yellow circle with what sort of looks like a crooked musical note in the middle. It's the best description I have. And then we get a little exposition from Sisko and Odo, who explain that this is the emblem of the Alliance for Global Unity. They call themselves the Circle. They're an extremist faction who believe in Bajor for the Bajorans. That's never a good thing.
Yeah.
All other species are inferior and should be expelled from the planet. The symbol has appeared all over Bajor, but it's the first time it's appeared on the station.
That's only a little bit concerning.
Yeah. Miles says if they think scrawling a few signs is going to get rid of us, they've got another thing coming. I always like Miles' reactions to things. Sisko thinks they're just trying to show us that we're vulnerable. And Odo says not to be overly concerned because this section is a low security area. And Sisko says, as of now, Constable, there are no low security areas on the station.
Go onto Space Amazon and order box of wireless cameras for Odo. Actually, I get a whole case of them. You know.
Why can't we have some cameras? I think it's funny that we have graffiti 300 years in the future. Like, somebody actually took some paint and painted some graffiti on the station. It just seems like a weird way to make a statement, but okay.
Well, interesting enough, in The Expanse, they still do graffiti, except they have, like, little, almost like wands that you wipe across something and it puts the pigment down onto the surface. That's actually kind of cool.
Like a Harry Potter wand?
Kind of.
Interesting.
Remember those old hand scanners you used to get?
Hand scanners?
Yeah. They would hold your hand and move across a page.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. They're like that, but they put like the ink down or the pigment down onto the surface.
Interesting.
But this is one of those areas where the modern world has actually outpaced Star Trek of we have cameras everywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, and not just cameras for law enforcement or for security. Everybody has a camera.
I think I wrote in my notes somewhere later where this is a good example of something that if Miles had seen this, he would have just taken a picture on his phone and sent it to Sisko, right? He wouldn't have made them come down and look at it. But yeah, they don't even think to do that in 1993.
Right.
After the ad break, Dax comes into Sisko's office. He's been thinking about their mission here, and he worries that the turmoil on Bajor will unravel everything they've accomplished over the last year. Dax is like, yeah, I told you this would be a tough assignment. Thanks, Dax.
She's very helpful.
Yeah, he says, what if I told you I knew someone who could bring stability to Bajor? Someone who could unite the factions and give us a chance to do our job? And she says, I'd say give Kira the runabout. I love that line. He's a little surprised she knows about that. But, you know, people who work together talk. This is reality. That's, I think, why I liked it.
Yeah.
He wonders if he lets her take the runabout and she rescues the guy, what do we say to the Cardassians? And Dax says the question is, what do they say to us? They swore they released all their Bajoran prisoners. Sisko nods and she leaves. He spins the baseball on the table, resting his head in his hands, like he's still thinking about it. Sisko comes out of his office and nods at Kira, which Kira takes as a yes to her request. Sisko then tells Miles that Major Kira needs a runabout. Oh, Miles says, she's going to Cardassia 4 after all. And Sisko wonders if there's anyone on the station she didn't tell. Miles doubts that she mentioned it to Quark, which was pretty funny. Sisko wonders if they can prevent the Cardassians from picking up the runabout's power signature. Miles says some sciencey stuff about the deflector shield, blah, blah, blah. By the time he's done, the Cardassians will think it's a Lysepian transport. Sisko's like, seems like you've already been giving this some thought.
I could see Miles being up for a technical challenge. Plus, we already know he does not like the Cardassians. So I could see him enjoying this as, you know, a little technical project to how to hide a ship from the Cardassians.
Right.
And it was a nice touch. Do you notice when Dax came down the stairs, when she just sort of grabbed Kira's arm? And just sort of looked at her. I was like, oh, that was nice. That was sort of a very friendly kind of thing.
Yep. Like, I gave you a plug.
Yeah.
I think in these first three episodes, which we've now watched, I think we see a lot of progression of the relationships between the characters.
Yeah.
Which I have to tell you is, you know, my number one thing, right, in Star Trek is I love the relationships and how the people interact and what it does for each of them, you know, mm-hmm. just in their lives. And so, yeah, we see a lot more of that. Because I thought you were going to say, when we saw more of the progression of the relationship, I thought you were going to say Dax and Kira, but you said Dax and Sisko. And yeah, we do see a little bit of that. And it's not so much a progression there as it is maybe an illumination of the kind of relationship they've had in the past, but we haven't been able to see yet.
Oh, that's a good point. But also, remember there was that very harsh scene in the episode of Dax where she sort of pointed out quite brutally that Curzon was your friend.
Right.
That would have been quite hard to hear for someone that's been your friend and mentor for so many years.
Well, he died.
But for our perspective as a human, that would be, you know, a very different thing from the Trills who have this, you know, ability for your memories to go on and who you were to continue. So,
yeah, back to Kira's quarters and she's got a non-uniform outfit on. Very secret rebel mission-like. An orangey color on the bottom with a pale green top and a weird dark red rope vest. It looked like a rope vest from the 70s. That was the only part I had a problem with.
Oh, funny.
Star Trek has never been great at casual clothes. I would say maybe not until Picard, where the casual clothes are great.
Yes.
And this is pretty good, except for maybe that rope vest, which is a little weird.
It would be a good cosplay outfit.
Yeah.
I think that rope vest might have taken a little from fashion trends at the time. Remember, like, waistcoats were really big around 93.
You mean like vests?
Yes.
Yes, they were. They were very big in the early 90s for sure, on men and women. Sisko and Miles come in. Miles is dressed in a similar casual fashion, but in blues and greens. And also, his outfit is a bit ill-fitting by comparison, and it does not suit him as well as Kira's little rebel outfit.
Yeah.
Sisko wants to wish her luck and tell her that Chief O'Brien will be accompanying her on her mission. She doesn't think it's a good idea to have a Federation officer along. She says it could cause complications for you later. Sisko accepts the risk and says, "You're an excellent pilot, Major, but Mr. O'Brien is better, and I want to make sure I get my runabout back in one piece." He also says he needs Lee Nalas back on Bajor as much as Kira does. Miles adds that he's seen how the Cardassians treat their prisoners. No one should have to suffer like that. Kira says if the Cardassians get their hands on us, we'll be the ones suffering. "Well, they'll have to catch us first," Miles says. This is where I wrote in my notes. This is not an attractive neckline on Miles. It looks great on Kira. It does not work on Miles.
It was a little bit of a slobby outfit.
Yes, it definitely was. She says she could use the company, though. So even though she was maybe a little bit concerned about it, and I thought maybe she would fight about it, she seems pretty happy that he's coming along.
Well, it kind of makes sense that he would be helpful to have along because he's had a lot more experience with those shuttles. He's probably been trained on them. He probably has a significantly larger number of flight hours on these things, whereas Kira, at best, probably has a fraction of it. So as a pilot, you probably want the most experienced person you can get.
On the shuttle, lots of shuttly noises are happening, beeping and engines firing up. I thought maybe they should paint the shuttle in casual colors, too, so it doesn't stand out as a Starfleet shuttle.
Yeah.
But as they're firing up the shuttle, Kira says, "We need to clear something up. We either come back with Lee Nalas or we don't come back at all." Miles says, "Understood," without hesitation, which surprises Kira, but he's all in, and that impresses her. I think Miles has always been an all-in kind of guy.
Yes. I mean, I was impressed to see that Miles is prepared to follow Kira to death or glory. That's very Klingon, I thought. We will succeed or we will die.
Well, maybe. I mean, maybe it's just confidence or he's just accepted the risk and he's, you know, just showing that he has confidence in the mission. You don't want somebody who is like, "Oh, well, hopefully we make it back." I don't think you want that.
Well, question here, a little over analysis.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think Miles volunteered or was he ordered?
I didn't think about it, but I would have to guess that Sisko asked him if he would go, and he agreed.
Interesting.
You know, he probably, just based on some of the other things that happened in these first three episodes, I don't know that he would have ordered O'Brien to do it.
Yeah.
Because he's risking his own neck by doing it.
Yeah.
By putting the shuttle out there. So does he also want to then assume that Miles is prepared to risk his neck?
Yeah. My assumption here was that Miles volunteered to do this. I mean, he has history with the Cardassians, and he's already figured out how to modify the shuttle to help Kira. So I would see him taking it as sort of a point of honor. That's sort of the character I get from Miles.
Yeah, plus he made that comment about knowing what it was like for Cardassian prisoners.
Yeah.
So that probably immediately made him want to help.
Yeah.
So finally Kira says, "Then take us out, Mr. O'Brien," and off they go into the ad break. After the ad break, the shuttle is flying along, and they're 30 minutes from reaching Cardassia 4 when they're scanned by a navigational control post. At first, Miles is like, oh, it's probably just a routine scan. But when they're hailed, he says, well, then again, we could be in serious trouble. Like, okay.
Thank you for your confidence, Miles.
Yeah. They're out of visual contact range, so they decide to try bluffing. And they say they are a Lysepian transport ship. The Cardassian voice on the other side says their subspace field emitters appear to be malfunctioning. Miles figures that little sciencey trick that he did to mask their identity is probably causing it. So Kira replies to the control post that everything is fine and they're working on fixing the issue. They say they can send a repair ship to help, but Kira makes up a story about having to get a shipment of seeds to Gull Moraine, and any delay could ruin the entire crop, not to mention the gull's mood. The Cardassian voice says, understood, and lets them go.
Yeah.
They both breathe a sigh of relief, and Miles asks who Gull Moraine is, and Kira says she just made him up. That move seems pretty ballsy, and Miles laughs.
This gives me flashbacks to Star Trek Undiscovered Country.
Really?
Yeah. Remember where they fly into Klingon space and Uhura is reading
Klingon? Oh my gosh. Yeah. She's like, they have paper books, right?
Yeah.
They arrive in synchronous orbit above the labor camp and start scanning for Bajoran life forms. Not surprisingly, Miles finds about a dozen Bajorans. Kira asks if there's any way to beam up more than two at a time, and Miles says no, and as soon as we beam the first two up, all hell is going to break loose in that camp. The trouble is there's no way of guaranteeing that Lee would be one of the first two, so they have to land. Of course.
Yep.
Now we go down to the planet, and some Cardassian guards are shouting at prisoners to work harder. It looks like they're just putting rocks in baskets. That's fun. This is just a desolate place with nothing but rocks, a few guards, and a handful of workers crawling around on the rocky terrain. Kira and Miles just come walking up like they're on a stroll, and Kira says, how do I look? And Miles says, I doubt there's a Cardassian alive that could resist you. I hope you're right, she says. I don't like the sound of this plan immediately. When a guard sees them, he yells for them to stop. Miles starts in on this whole thing about how she has an appointment in double quotes with the prefect. And then this guy starts negotiating that he'd like an appointment too. And it's gross. And I don't think I need to describe this in more detail. You get the idea of what's going on.
All I can say is Miles does a pretty good pimp.
Ugh.
Has he been hanging out with Quark too much?
Oh my God. It's just, we had to do something like this, didn't we? We were going so well. When Kira approaches the guy, he drops the force field, locking Miles out, but letting Kira in. When he thinks he's going to get lucky, she punches him and knocks him out awfully easily. Just as another guard comes around the corner, she pulls out her phaser and shoots the approaching guards.
Well, you say easily, but I would counter that with she's been fighting the Cardassians for a long time. So I would guess the Cardassians, because they're very rule-based, have methods of combat and of self-defense and how they operate. And Kira knows the best way of taking down a Cardassian in their uniform, which I assume had some kind of more function than just being cloth or whatever material it is. So maybe it has body panels or some kind of protection. And she knows how to take down a Cardassian effectively and quickly.
It was a little hard to believe, though. I mean, she's so tiny. I don't know how she could have gotten enough leverage for that sort of uppercut that she does.
Yeah.
It was just a little hard to believe.
Well, I don't know if we've ever covered... Well, Bajor is quite a large planet, so I don't know if we've ever covered if it has higher gravity than Cardassia. So...
Oh, there's an overanalysis.
Maybe the Bajorans have a lot more mass and more strength. And if you put them on, in a side-by-side with a Cardassian, the Bajoran could beat the crap out of them, as they say.
Okay, I'll accept that argument.
Thank you.
Although I still think this plan is weak. It's on par with all of our terrible plans. We seem to think exactly 1 second into the future.
Okay, I think this one is actually slightly better than some of their other plans.
Are you sure? She drops the force field so Miles can enter. Miles shoots another guard up on the ridge. Somehow then she runs right up to Lee and says, "Lee Nollis, we've come to get you out of here." Quite a coincidence that he was just right there by the spot they came in when they couldn't tell who he was on the scanners. Anyway, the guy next to him fesses up about the smuggling his earring out. I'm just like, we don't have time to talk about this, but we have to talk about it. Miles is trying to shoo them along, but a Cardassian guard immediately shoots Lee, and they pick him up and rally all of the others to run, kind of dragging Lee along. Then four Cardassian guards appear from behind and start shooting. They quickly get pinned behind some rocks. The guy who smuggled the earring tells them to get Lee back and the others can stay behind to take fire, but Lee says he won't allow it. The guy's like, "We did this for you," and he tells Kira to get him back safely, and she says, "You have my word," and grabs Lee and starts running with him toward the ship.
Just an observation. I think they should have brought more guns.
I'm telling you, they make terrible plans. They arm the Bajorans that they leave behind, and they get Lee to the ship. They get a handful of the other prisoners into the tiny runabout. I just keep thinking, it can't smell great in there. It's tiny, it's crowded. I often have this problem when watching movies or TV shows where I think, that can't smell good. Like Master and Commander.
Right. Yes.
Yes, you were thinking the same thing I was.
Well, I just remember the part during the movie where you lean over to me and say, "Can you imagine what that place smells like?"
Oh, I'm easily offended by smells. Miles says he's picking up two Gator-class warships entering orbit. Uh-oh. He's like, "We have to get out of here. We have 1 minute, 45 seconds. Then we have 1 minute, 30 seconds. And Lee says, "You can't leave those men behind." Why can't we beam them out now? Why were we not just now beaming them out two at a time? I was so confused by that.
Yeah, did they have some kind of dampening field that went into effect?
Yeah, because they were outside of the shield. So yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Miles says, "If we don't leave now, we never will. Take us home, Chief," she says. "Yes, sir." He closes the door and they take off. Lee looks irked and disappointed that they left others behind just to save him.
I like how Kira can make those kind of tough decisions.
Yeah.
That was some great acting by Nana Visitor. I mean, when she's in the doorway there, the tension and just how she is so on edge waiting for them. I love the portrayal of that.
But she's always very mission focused, and her mission was to get Lee home, and she's going to do it.
It was only a little thing, but it was so well played.
Yep. They arrive at DS9 and Bashir's waiting for them at the door. Lee tries to tell the doctor to tend to the others, but he wants to see Lee's phaser wound first. As Lee collapses, Bashir calls Dax and asks her to beam them to the infirmary. Kira enters Sisko's office saying, "Commander, I need to talk to you." But before she says anything else, Sisko says, "Oh, Major, I'm glad you could join us." And we see that Gul Dukat is on the screen. Kira says, "Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't know you were busy. I'll just wait outside." And Sisko's like, "No, hold on, there's something I want you to hear." And then Dukat says, "Major, I just informed Commander Sisko that the Cardassian High Command has issued a formal apology to the people of Bajor. We had no idea that Bajoran prisoners were still being held on Cardassia 4. Such detentions are a direct violation of Supreme Directive 2645, and I assure you the camp prefect will be chastised accordingly. What about the prisoners that were left behind?" she asks. "They're already en route to Bajor." "Well," she says, visibly surprised, "I look forward to their safe return." He says he hopes that their quick response to this unfortunate situation will prove once and for all that Cardassia is no longer your enemy, and then he hangs up.
This was surprising.
Well, yeah, Kira's like, what just happened? And Sisko is also surprised. And then they wonder why they're being so accommodating. And Sisko thinks they should just be grateful it's happening and they can figure out the motives later. And then he congratulates her on a successful mission. She nods and leaves. And Sisko kind of smiles like he's impressed. And he's also happy to have her back. And probably Miles, too.
And the runabout.
Oh, yeah.
He probably has to sign a requisition form for each one, and he's already lost one.
Oh, my gosh, yeah, he left one in battle lines. Back to the infirmary, and Bashir is fixing up Lee. He asks the patient how he feels, and he says better. And then Bashir starts making small talk with him about the battles that he led against the Cardassians, saying he's a bit of a history buff. The guy stops him from talking and says, "Doctor, I think you'll find others enjoy talking about those days far more than I do." "Of course," Bashir says, "I understand completely." Either this guy's very humble or they're trying to hint at something here.
Yeah. It's also true that a lot of veterans don't want to talk about their experiences.
That's true.
So it seemed also kind of odd that Bashir was doing that. Because surely we'd have had some training in dealing with PTSD or people who've suffered combat fatigue, that kind of thing.
Yeah, except I think this guy, the stories are such legends that he couldn't quite help himself and was also maybe buying into the legend more than thinking about it on a... Personal level.
Yeah. Okay, that makes sense.
This guy was so familiar, another guest star with a familiar face. I had to look him up, and it's Richard Boehmer. I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, but he's a Golden Globe nominee for the movie West Side Story.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he was also apparently on Twin Peaks, but that's not a show I really watched, so I didn't connect those dots. But yeah, again, another strong acting guest star. Although, we should have done a song in this episode then. Should have done a little dance. That would have been great. DS9 the musical. I would have watched that.
Yeah, is it too early to have a musical episode?
Oh my gosh, I wish. Oh, like a lost opportunity. Sisko, Kara, and Lee are walking through the promenade. Lee talks about working at this station in one of the ore processing plants at one time, so he can't quite believe that he's back here. I did write down in my notes that thank goodness it looks like he's had a shower. Oh, I can't help myself.
No, you can't.
Sisko says, I think you'll find things have changed considerably. Odo approaches at this point saying, a transport carrying Minister Jero has arrived. Sisko tells Kira she should have the honor welcoming him aboard, and she heads off to do that. They walk a little farther to this cafeteria place again, and some Bajorans stand up when they see Lee. And then Sisko says, if you're hungry, the Replomat, there's the new name for the place, has some passable Bajoran food. Lee says he's a bit tired and would rather see his quarters. He is a bit reserved, which I suppose makes sense.
Yeah.
But before they get very far, a small crowd has gathered, and it appears you've been recognized, Sisko says.
It was when they were standing in the doorway. I liked how the Bajorans were standing up, and there were people in the background who were like stopping and looking.
Yes.
I mean, this guy is a hero to their people.
Yeah.
So it's sort of surprising that...
Maybe they liked West Side Story.
Oh, it could be. Can I get a selfie?
Oh my gosh.
So there seems to be a lot of hero worship going on.
Yes. Minister Jero comes through the airlock, and it's Tony Award-winning actor Frank Langella. Have to get another seasoned actor in here, a trend we are continuing from the first season.
Well, most importantly, yeah. It's Richard Nixon. There is an old Vulcan proverb.
Only Nixon can go to Deep Space Nine. Wasn't that what it was?
No. I think we're seriously crossing genres here.
Yes. Minister Jero greets Kira, and he's wearing a nice maroon suit, and a woman in deep purple is walking behind him, maybe an assistant or something. She has no lines, but we do see her several times in that purple outfit.
She's a political NPC.
Yes. He asks if Lee is all right. She says he is, especially when you consider what he's been through. Lee Nalas alive, Jero says. Who would have ever imagined? The prophets were kind to you today, Major. She says, I'd say they were kind to all of us. They start walking toward the promenade. Jero says, you know, your little adventure made you some enemies in the Chamber of Ministers. Kira's not surprised. She's like, all I did was risk my life. But Jero says, what you did today, Major, was declare war on Cardassia. Thankfully, they declined the invitation.
I mean, the minister is technically correct.
Yes.
Here. I mean, she violated Cardassian territory. She attacked Cardassian officers.
As a member of the military.
Yeah, right.
But still, she was just one person. I would say they should be more concerned with the fact that she was in a Federation ship, but I guess they don't know that because Miles masked it.
Yeah.
Well, she says she'd do it again if it meant bringing Lee Nalas home. I'm sure you would, Jero says, but I have to officially warn you that the next time you disobey orders will mean the end of your military career. But as a private citizen, I want to thank you for what you've done on this day. That's good to hear, she says, though she looks confused and conflicted. And then he tells her to take him to see Lee. I have to say, there's really no way Frank Langella in this role at this moment in this show is playing a good guy. There's just no way. I know nothing about this storyline or this episode at this point, but absolutely, he is up to something. Like evil Vedic Wind before him, I see something coming.
He's so good.
He's so smooth.
I mean, he plays a great politician.
He really does play a great politician. This must have been before Nixon. Lee is trying to hide from the crowd as Odo pushes them all back. Sisko tells him he probably needs to say a few words or no one will leave. Lee definitely does not want to, but he agrees. In front of the crowd, he says, it's good to be free. It's good to know that after all our years of struggle, Bajor is finally free. Jero approaches at this point and says, yes, it is good to be free. And he walks through the crowd and up to Lee. It really is you, he says. They introduce themselves to each other, and Jero says he's delighted to welcome him home. Then he whispers that he'd like to address the crowd. As a politician, he doesn't want to pass up an opportunity like this. Go right ahead, Lee says. It's not that big of a crowd. It's like six people.
Extras are expensive.
Was Morn in the crowd?
I did not see Morn in the crowd.
We haven't seen Morn yet?
I have not.
But he is in this episode, isn't he?
I don't think so. I didn't see him.
Oh, what?
Yeah, I don't see him in this episode.
Wow. I thought he was in every episode.
I did not have in my notes Morn. I did not see him
I
in this
I do
one.
Wonder, though, this three-parter, did it air as three separate episodes?
I do not know.
Because he's in the third one.
Yeah.
Jarrow turns around and says, "Fellow Bajorans, I have only one thing to ask you. Never forget this moment, because I promise you one day your children and grandchildren will ask you what it was like the day Leonalis returned to Bajor." The closed caption said, "Buzz of agreement," as people cheered. Lee does not look too into this. Not sure how he's going to be a uniting force as he's like backing away.
He does not seem thrilled at the hero worship that he's receiving for this.
No, he doesn't, which is probably what would make someone a good hero.
Yeah. The speech by Langella is beautifully delivered.
Yes. Sisko shows Lee into his guest quarters, saying he hopes they're satisfactory. Lee says, "I just spent 10 years in a Cardassian labor camp, so I'm just grateful for a moment's privacy." "Well, enjoy it while you can," Sisko says. "Judging from the crowd on the promenade, a moment may be all you get." Lee is surprised he hasn't been forgotten by now. "This morning I was a slave, and tonight I'm a hero." Sisko understands it might be overwhelming, but what Lee finds overwhelming is something he waited for his whole life has finally happened. The Cardassians are gone. "We won." And then he asks what a free Bajor is like. Sisko thinks he'll be pleased for the most part, but Bajor lacks strong leadership. Then he says, "But before you go off saving Bajor, maybe you'd like a good night's sleep." Lee says, "It sounds like I'm going to need it," and Sisko shakes his hand and leaves.
I mean, Sisko here lays out kind of how Bajor needs his help.
Yeah.
And he does seem pretty overwhelmed by it.
Yes. Well, and doesn't he also say, "And I need your help"?
Yeah, clearly the regions of Bajor are divided.
You know what this reminds me of a little bit?
Yeah.
First Contact.
Really?
He told him about the statue?
Oh, right.
That guy was not ready to be a hero. Although, I mean, this is slightly different.
Yeah. Where James Cromwell says, "I don't know who this historical figure is, but he's not me."
Yeah, that's what I mean. It feels a little bit like that.
Oh, exactly.
I'm surprised the one who brought that up. That's normally your job, to bring First Contact into nearly every episode. Almost like Morn. Now we go to Quark's. And it's payday, and Quark is counting out latinum for Rom and himself. "One for you, six for me." "One for you, six for me."
Quark is so awful to poor Rom.
And Rom is annoyed. He's tired of this ratio, and he says, "It's not fair." And Quark says, "You're right, it's not fair." But of course, Rom is prematurely excited as the counting starts again. Now it's one for you, seven for me. I think we all saw that coming. Rom gets annoyed and says he's going to bed to dream of an equal share of profits. "Dream on," Quark shouts.
Quark is living up to the Ferengi rules of acquisition. Exploitation begins at home.
Absolutely. Quark keeps counting when you hear a door open behind him. Quark turns around, annoyed. What is it now? Oh, but it's not Rom. He's suddenly attacked by three dudes in maroon robes and nondescript facial masks.
I bet they were hiding in the trellises outside the bar.
Oh, of course they were. They were hiding behind the grates.
Yep.
As they take Quark down to the floor and muffle his screams, they come at his forehead with some kind of device that looks like a little red Pez dispenser, and then dramatic music plays us into the ad break.
It looks like one of those old, you know, the cigarette lighters you used to get from the cars.
Oh, yeah, that is what it looked like on the bottom. Yeah.
I think Sisko needs to arrange with Odo that anybody who's hooded and robed on the station just needs to be arrested. They're always up to trouble. They're either going to kidnap someone, or in this one, they're going to brand people with a cigarette lighter.
Oh, my gosh.
That includes Vedic Wynn, by the way.
When we get back from the ad break, Quark is coming to, and Bashir is shouting at him to hold still. You can see a tattoo of the circle on his forehead where the Pez dispenser was used. Quark asks if there will be a scar, as Bashir is running a dermal regenerator over the scar. He says it will repair the damaged tissue and prevent scarring if he holds still. Kira is standing in the background looking unamused. Sisko and Odo are on the other side of him, and Sisko asks if Quark recognized any of the assailants, but Quark says they were wearing masks and didn't say a word. Odo points out that the promenade is usually deserted at this hour, and no one saw them enter or leave. No video surveillance on the promenade? Come on.
Or even in Quark's bar. You'd think Quark would actually set up a camera or two.
I don't know that he would want things he was doing being recorded.
That's actually a very good point.
Yeah.
Odo might seize them as evidence.
They don't want him in the terrorist meeting room from episode 2, whatever that was.
That room is pretty useless. Odo just turns into a rat and wanders around in there.
That's true. Or a glass.
Yes.
That was a holosuite. But anyway. So Sisko wants all security personnel put on full alert. For some reason, Lee is there, and he's asking who is responsible for the attack. Kira explains it's the extremist group called the Circle. Their goal is to rid Bajor of all non-Bajorans. Lee is shocked that Bajorans would do this, which I thought was funny, because it's like saying, humans would do this? I mean, come on, it's a whole planet of people. Of course Bajorans would do this.
He does seem pretty surprised.
Yeah.
Although, wouldn't they all be shocked if he turned around and said, oh yes, I believe this too. All other races are inferior.
That would be shocking.
I mean, they don't know. He's been in a labor camp for years. Did they really know what he was like to start with? I mean, he could be an absolute screaming racist.
It's true. They don't really know. They only know about the stories of him fighting some Cardassian. Lee wonders why the provisional government, Drink, hasn't tried to stop them. Oh, they've tried, Sisko says, but the truth is the Circle is more organized than the government. Well, they'd better get organized, Quark says, because I intend to sue them for financial compensation. Sisko stands up and shouts, not now, Quark, which was kind of a shut up, Wesley moment, I felt.
Yes.
He says, people have grown impatient with the government's inability to get things done, so they turn to the Circle. Then Sisko heads out with Odo. Kira tells Lee we need someone the people will listen to speak out against these reactionaries. Bashir finishes up removing the brand on Quark's forehead.
That little tool can fix any kind of makeup.
Yeah. Lee leaves the bar and Kira follows. Quark asks, how do I look? And before she leaves, she turns and says, as handsome as ever, which makes him very happy. It's like, what? That was so stupid.
Quark can be very shallow at times.
Yeah.
Sometimes I wonder if in Ferengi culture, they really have a good understanding of sarcasm. Do they take things a little bit too literally?
Yeah. That's a good question. They're either lying or taking it literally.
The Ferengi's lying? That's fake news, by the way.
Fake news. In Sisko's quarters, we find that Jake is still awake. He's disappointed because his date was supposed to be tonight, but she canceled. Well, it happens, Sisko says. Jake says her father wouldn't let her go out with him because he's not Bajoran. Sisko kind of sighs. Oh, Jake, there are some things happening on Bajor, troubling things. I'm sorry you've become a victim of them. You don't deserve it. Nobody does. And then he kisses his head and tells him it's time for bed. So Jake goes to bed.
That was very sweet.
It was.
I mean, that was another one of those good father-son moments that this show is so great at portraying.
Yes.
I mean, just this very positive relationship between a father and a son. And I feel also somewhat realistic, as much as it can be in a sci-fi show, but I like the personal interactions. I also thought this was a little bit of an odd scene because Sisko didn't take the time to explain the situation to Jake. If you remember in the last episode,
yep. He
went to great lengths to explain the religious situation to Jake
and
try and give both sort of sides of the perspective of what was going on. Whereas here it was sort of like, oh, things are happening. It shouldn't affect you, but it is.
Well, it's also late at night and he doesn't know what's going to happen.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. Maybe he just thought Jake should go to bed and he needed more info before he would tell him anything.
Yeah. All right. I'll take that.
Sisko's obviously tired because he tries to go to bed, but then he gets a call from the Tigerian freighter docked on Upper Pylon 2. A very green, lizardy alien says his ship was preparing to depart the station for the Gamma Quadrant when he discovered a Bajoran stowaway.
Well, thank goodness, because we finally got the discount prop effect in this episode.
What?
Was it just me, or did this guy look like they put a turtle shell hat on him and a large green mustache?
I don't even remember that.
I was actually laughing because I'm like, wow, that looks really strange.
The Tigerian freighter captain said he was hoping you would know what to do with the stowaway. And then he steps aside. And of course, we see the stowaway is Lee. You knew that was coming. I don't think he's quite ready to be the leader of a free Bajor.
Yeah.
But do you think he ran right from Quark's to this ship? I mean, we were just in Quark's like 2 seconds ago.
Yes, I think he probably did.
Wow.
I think that was sort of the implication of that. He saw this, he saw what was going on.
Yeah.
And maybe he was just disgusted with the way the Bajorans were behaving.
Yeah.
He's a guy who had been fighting his entire life to free Bajor, gets back there and finds that all this petty infighting. And not only that, but also that an element of Bajoran society is being kind of bigoted against the other races. And he's horrified by it.
Right.
That's what I took away from that. And for his first reaction is, I just want to get away from here.
Now we jump to Sisko's office where he's talking to Lee. He says, the ship you were on isn't scheduled to return from the Gamma Quadrant for 2 years. And Lee says he planned to stay considerably longer. Then he claps his hands together and says, I'm going to tell you a story. During the occupation, I was a member of a minor resistance cell. One day, in the mountains surrounding some valley, we were ambushed by Cardassian troops. Only 3 of us managed to escape. We hid in the hills for 2 days, the lack of food and water eventually driving us into the valley. We made our way to a ridge overlooking a small lake. I was the only one still carrying a phaser, so I went ahead to scout for the enemy. Halfway down the embankment, I slipped, went sprawling on my back down the edge of the lake, just as a huge Cardassian emerged from the water. He must have just finished bathing. He stood there, frozen in surprise, wearing only his underwear, shivering in the cold. I looked up at him, too stunned to move. When he moved towards his weapon, I realized I still had my own phaser, and I shot him. His body fell on top of me, and that's how my companions found us a few moments later. One of them recognized him as Gulza Rael, responsible for the massacre of half a dozen Bajoran villages. I tried to tell them what had happened, but they'd already convinced themselves that I had killed him in some savage struggle. No matter how hard I tried to deny the story, they kept telling it to others until it seemed like all of Bajor had heard it. Soon every victory won by the resistance was attributed to my leadership. Stories of my brilliance, my daring, my courage grew more and more unbelievable. My reputation followed me to the labor camp, where my mere presence seemed to inspire my fellow prisoners. Yet I had done nothing but shoot an unarmed Cardassian in his underwear, and I'll never forget the look on his face when he died. He was so embarrassed. So you see, Commander, I allowed myself to be a slave to my reputation for all of these years. And now it's enough. I'm not the man they think I am. Sisko says perhaps not, but Bajor doesn't need a man. It needs a symbol. And that's what you are. No one is asking you to lead troops into battle. I saw you in front of the crowd on the promenade. They look at you and they see strength and honor and decency. They look at you and see the best in themselves. But it's all based on a lie, Lee says. No, Sisko says. It's based on a legend. And legends are as powerful as any truth. Bajor still needs that legend. It needs you. Such a Star Trek-y speech.
Oh, both of them deliver fantastic speeches and statements in this section of the show. I mean, it's the advantage of having, you know, good actors deliver these sort of monologues, if they can actually make them work. I mean, it's also very Star Trek. I mean, yes. Sisko's response is beautiful.
Definitely, because the captain always has to give something inspiring.
Yeah.
You know, in Star Trek, that's a very classic thing. And in this case, it's
Sisko.
Yeah,
he does it in such a convincing way as well.
Yeah.
I mean, he seems very genuine when he's saying, you know, the truth doesn't necessarily matter. The legend is what matters.
Yeah, it's totally true. The legend is always what matters. Hardly ever does the truth matter in this particular situation, especially when you're talking about inspiration. Like he said, nobody's asking you to lead troops into battles. They're asking you to inspire them.
Yeah, and I think that's the important difference here of the legend will work for inspiring the best out of the Bajoran people who are in this terrible place right now of the infighting and the bigotry. And he's the legend and the symbol of what they can be.
Yes. Of what they want to be.
Yes. Yes. Thank you. What they want to be.
Right.
I kind of feel sorry for the guy because it really is like First Contact, where James Cromwell's character doesn't want to be this hero.
Right.
Where he says, I see dollar signs.
I don't remember that line, but yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we were waiting this whole episode to find out why he was so reticent, right? Why he wasn't willing to sort of step up into that role. And now we find out what that reason is. And he's been doubting himself really for the entire time that he was in prison. And, you know, however long it was before that, they don't spell out exactly how long ago this was.
Well, he was in the labor camp for 10 years, so.
We don't know how long before that this incident occurred.
Right.
But for however long it's been, he has been doubting himself and feeling that he didn't deserve, you know, the legend, or he didn't deserve whatever people were attributing to him. So by the time he got to this point, he must just be a mess inside.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and I'm kind of slightly surprised that Sisko didn't bring up, talking about the character of the man, that he didn't try to play off this character or this legend that he actually is.
Yeah.
He doesn't seek to exploit it. And you could almost say to the guy at that point, doesn't that say something about the type of person you are, that you're not trying to live off this fame? It's the line of, you know, great leaders are forced into the role. They don't seek the role.
I think it makes sense that even if Sisko is thinking that, maybe he keeps that to himself. There's no need for him to try to convince the guy that he is a great man. The guy already thinks that he's not. He's taking a much different approach, a more of a leadership approach, which is, it doesn't matter what you think. It doesn't matter who you are. What matters is what people think, right? What other people are saying and thinking and what they believe. That's the thing that matters. So I think in the leadership podcast here, you know, he's done the right thing.
Yeah.
Well, he's clearly a good person. He just doesn't quite know what to do with the situation he's in.
Yeah.
And I think he doesn't want to disappoint all of Bajor. You know, it's that's a pretty
really
big
good
thing.
Point. I didn't think about that.
Yep. Now we go to Ops, and Minister Jero, Lee, and the Purple Girl are coming up the elevator.
Uh-oh, Nixon is back.
And did you notice now Lee is wearing a purple uniform? He's wearing that light purple color of the Bajoran uniform that we saw Neela wear, and also Inara.
They could have got him a different color one, I guess. I mean, no. He's a hero of the people, and you give him just like a regular uniform?
Right. He didn't even get a bunch of medals.
Yeah, give him some flair.
Sisko shakes their hands, and Jaro announces that Lee is now Navark Lee. As of yesterday's unanimous assembly vote, Navark, Lee says, there's never been one before. They felt any existing title was inadequate, so they created a new one for me. Great.
Apparently that's a real word as well.
Yeah, well, I looked it up too.
It's apparently a word of Greek origin, meaning commander of ships, so it's sort of roughly equivalent to an admiral, was what I read. Pretty good title.
That's actually a pretty good title.
I'd like that on my business card.
Navark? Navark, yeah. James?
I think it'd just be James, Navark.
Sisko heard that thousands of people showed up to greet him when he arrived on Bajor. Yes, he says, it was quite a celebration, but I couldn't stay long. Sisko asks why not, and Minister Jaro said, because the Navark needed to report to his new post. He's been made the Bajoran liaison officer to Deep Space Nine.
Uh-oh.
Sisko says, but I already have one of those. And Minister Jaro says, not anymore, you don't. Major Kira has been recalled to Bajor. Jaro goes into Sisko's office as everybody looks at each other, shocked. Now, there's an example of bad leadership, where you don't tell Kira in advance that this has happened. Instead, you just say it as if she's not standing right there.
Well, I think that fits Nixon.
Oh, that's a good point. To be continued. Dang, I knew that Frank Langella was up to no good.
Well, I feel that Nixon didn't want somebody as revered as Lee and Alice around the place, because there would probably be constant comparisons with him.
Yeah. At this point, we have no idea why this has happened. So that's a pretty good guess that he was, because it doesn't really make sense of why you would get this big hero who you think is a great leader and is going to unite all of Bajor, and then you put him on the space station? That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. I mean, the two reasons for doing it would be, one, security, because let's say, you know, a faction within Bajor wanted to kill him because he would be a unifying force. Mm-hmm. And the other side for doing it would be because he would potentially, even unintentionally, usurp your power.
Yeah, that makes sense.
People would look to him. You could imagine it in a meeting with Minister Jaro and somebody comes up with some idea and Jaro's like, oh yeah, that's good. And everybody turning to Lee and Alice and saying, what do you think?
Oh, geez, yeah. That would be annoying.
Especially if it's someone who has such a legendary status.
Right. Have we met anyone from Bajor who is not a jerk?
People coming up from the surface seem to be a little jerky.
Yeah.
Oh, and stabby as well. Don't forget that.
Oh, Kaio Paka, I guess, but she's out.
Yep.
But yeah, nobody else.
Well, Beryl is a pretty nice guy. Good
That's
hair
true.
As well.
He's kind of a dud, but yeah, he at least doesn't seem evil.
Right.
Okay, well, end of the episode.
And a to be continued.
And a to be continued. So it's just the beginning of the story, but the end of the episode. Do you have any over-analysis to share?
Yes, I have a few points to share.
Okie doke.
Well, first of all, let's deal with Sisko declaring war on Cardassian Empire.
Okay.
He loaned a Federation shuttle with Starfleet personnel for a covert mission against Cardassia. So wouldn't you think Sisko's superiors would get a little bit upset about that? Or do you think he had enough plausible deniability in this?
No, he doesn't have any plausible deniability. He knew the whole thing.
But if Kira and Miles were captured, Sisko could say, but she was just going on a run to pick up some samples.
Yeah, as far as he knew, because there was that other story, the official story that he made up that I didn't mention because it didn't seem that important and never came up again. But yes, he did have an official story of what Kira was supposedly doing. She was off gathering some samples or something somewhere. And of course, since there's no video surveillance, there's no cameras to show that they were, you know, wearing their sexy outfits and not the uniforms. So there's no evidence.
And I don't know if I'd call Miles' outfit that.
That's true. Just curious. But and even hers wasn't either.
It was a totally wrong word.
You know what I mean? It was their casual outfits. There was no evidence of that. And if he didn't enter anything into the log, then I guess so.
Yeah. I wondered about that, of how much of a risk he was taking. Okay, so there's that point. The next one, I think, is, why were the Cardassians holding on to Lee Nalas? What was their goal here? Was it simply to punish the guy? Did they not actually know who he was? Which I could see as possible. Or alternatively, were they holding on to him because they wanted to use him at some point in the future? I mean, we already saw in Next Generation, when they tortured Picard, that they could do some kind of conditioning on people. And maybe they were figuring at some point in the future they could use him maybe as a figurehead or as a stooge to get the Cardassians back onto Bajor.
Yeah. I don't know. We don't actually touch on that at all in the three-part story. So it's hard to know if they actually had a point in keeping him or if they didn't even know. Who knows?
Yeah. My assumption is they simply didn't know that it was him.
Yeah, because I feel like if they knew that he had killed one of the generals, they would have killed him.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They would have made a huge show trial out of it.
You know, right.
To demoralize the Bajoran resistance.
Yes.
And I think my final over-analysis point was the way the Cardassians caved very quickly into giving an apology and going, oh, oops, we didn't know this was happening. It was all the commander's fault of the labor camp.
Well,
that should have been a red flag right there. The Cardassians are up to something.
Yeah, yeah. And we obviously don't find out any of that in this episode.
Especially with Gul Dukat being sort of the face of that.
Right. Nobody trusts him on Twitter. I don't know much about Gul Dukat, but I know on Twitter that people are afraid of him.
Yes, he's a great character.
Yeah.
Already we've seen how he lies. I mean, like, remember with the Odo where he said they played their game once and Dukat cheated?
Right.
So if Gul Dukat is telling you something, then there's a good chance that it may be not the truth.
Yeah.
And one final point. Is
I love how many final points you have.
I have a lot of final points.
Yes, carry on.
I'll just carry on.
Yes, yes.
And I think another point I have to make is we're getting this very much this sense of Bajor being this society in chaos, of they're having problems with various factions on the planet. When they were talking about how there were race riots on Bajor, were they talking about different Bajoran races? I mean, do Bajorans have... And I don't think we've really covered... I'm pretty sure we have not covered this in the show. If Bajorans have racial divides,
right.
Or are we talking species divides?
Yeah.
Of they were objecting to non-Bajorans on the planet. I read that as non-Bajoran.
Yeah.
And even though the Bajorans clearly are having factional problems, I didn't think it was race-based.
I guess it kind of makes sense that you might just call it race riots if you're just trying to kick people off who are different from you, not so much about actual racial tensions within your species.
But yeah, Bajor has some problems.
Yeah, Bajor has some big problems. Okay, any other overanalysis?
No, that wraps it up for me.
Okay. I guess we can move to women in the future. I have to say, I didn't actually take any notes on women in the future, but certainly Kira was well represented in this episode. She was the hero. She risked everything to go and rescue Lee Nalas, and she did it because she felt like he was going to help bring her divided people back together. So I think she was doing it for selfless reasons.
And I think she did pay the price. I mean, they really did get revenge on her.
Well, I mean... She was risking her life.
Ah, okay.
And she survived.
Yes.
She just lost her job.
Yeah.
And we don't really know why yet, but we do find out.
I mean, both personal and professional risk.
Yeah.
She survived one.
I mean, I guess the way I'm looking at it is pretty much everything she did had nothing to do with her gender. So I give that an A+. And even the firing of her there at the end, or the recalling her back to Bajor, had nothing to do with her gender. Great. So it's just a part of the story. It's just another character. She's just another soldier. That's really kind of all I ask. We saw very little of Dax in this episode, so that was a bummer.
We did see that wonderful little piece of the friendship between Dax and Kira.
Yeah, just like she was in that one scene, and then she had the quick little friendship moment with Kira, but that was about it. And, I mean, no sexual harassment. Julian didn't creep on anyone. That was great. Have we crossed the line? When we went into season two, are we going to stop with the nonsense? Well, okay.
I am unsure.
I may have forgotten one thing, which is they did have to pretend like Kira was a prostitute when they got to Cardassia 4.
Well, the difference today would be, I think, that at least one of the Cardassians would probably be able to be interested in Miles without a huge write-in campaign to cancel the show.
That's true. But... I mean, I don't know. It was the 90s, and that probably seemed like a safe bet of a story. I probably would have left that out or found some other way to do it. Ultimately, when I was watching that scene, and Kira and Miles just come walking up to the force field, all I could think was, here comes another stupid plan. These people make the worst plans. They do not know how to think about, five moves into the future. They're just walking up to the... What the heck are they doing? And then they get there, and he's trying to say that, she's a prostitute without saying it, because, again, it was the 90s, and language was still pretty restricted on TV. And I just went, oh.
I can hear the cries of it corrupting children.
So I think apart from that, Women in the Future was, oh my God, I don't even know what I'm saying. I mean, I want to give it all thumbs up and say that the Women in the Future section is all ribbons and roses or whatever a term might be. But really, that's kind of a step backward.
But do you think that was more of a reflection on the behavior of the Cardassians, that they were exploiting a known weakness?
Of course it was. It's too easy.
Yeah.
Think of something better. Make a better plan. I'm sick of the terrible plans we make. I feel like we could have made a better plan. Even at the end when they were kind of trying to get away, they didn't even think to use the transporter. Sometimes they just aren't smart enough in the writing, even though these people are supposed to be very smart.
Yeah. Like, why didn't they take any more weapons with them? Both of them managed to hide phasers on themselves.
Yeah.
Why couldn't they have taken like another half a dozen? I mean, especially if you know some of the people at that camp are freedom fighters, so have been trained in the use of weapons. Imagine the result if they'd armed all the people that were escaping.
Right. Yeah, good point. All right, well, I think that's it for Women in the Future. So let's move on to rating. Thumbs up, thumbs down, or thumbs neutral. What is your rating?
Absolute thumbs up. Thoroughly enjoyable episode.
I also give it a thumbs up. I thought it was great.
Good to see Richard Nixon in an earlier role.
The only thing that is kind of throwing me here is this is why I'm not so sure we should watch the episodes in advance, because I feel like it impacts my rating for the for this episode, and I don't want it to, because the episode should maybe be complete.
Yeah. In that case, we should adjust how we're doing it, and in future, we will simply watch the single part before we review and discuss the episode.
But even as a standalone episode, just the thing that you sit down and watch, it's actually quite entertaining. So, and I would still give it a thumbs up. But knowing the overall arc, I do think kind of interferes with my ability to just rate this particular thing on its own.
Gotcha. Yeah, I think you're right there.
Okay, that's it?
That is it.
So, season 2, episode 1, in the bag. So we'll move on next week to episode 2.
I'm very excited. I'm just amazed we managed to get you through the first season and into the second. I'm very happy.
It was not easy. I almost gave up a couple times, especially at the beginning.
Yes.
But nope, we're into it now. We got to keep going.
Hey, I am totally down with that.
Well, in the meantime, if you'd like to tell us your own overanalysis of this or any episode, or if you just want to say something nice, please email us at rebingeit@gmail.com or tweet us at rebingeit. Also, check us out on talkthroughmedia.com. You can leave feedback for us there and listen to all of our other awesome podcasts.
Thanks for joining us on the Rebinge Deep Space Nine podcast.
That's it for me.
And that's it from me.